I'm Shelley Schlender. It's 8:35. You're tuned to the end of the Heart Attack Chronicles, where we have two guests in the studio who are experts on heart disease and heart health, who are going to share with you their insights about how you can keep your heart healthy. And let's go ahead and have each of you introduce yourselves. Welcome Jamie Doucette and welcome Jeff Gerber. Jamie, let's start with you.
I'm Jamie Doucette, and I practice here at Boulder Heart for Boulder Community Hospital. I'm an interventional cardiologist, so I treat heart attack victims and patients that have acute coronary syndromes where their heart is threatened with heart attack.
Where their heart is threatened with heart attack, how do you tell?
Usually with EKG and the patient's clinical symptoms, as well as measurements of biomarkers from the bloodstream.
Jeff Gerber, welcome to KGNU. Tell us about yourself.
Thanks, Shelley. I'm a family doctor, and I'm located in Littleton, Colorado, and I have incorporated nutrition as a tool to help patients treat chronic diseases such as heart disease, heart attack, stroke, diabetes, and obesity. And I must say that our approach to nutrition is non-traditional. We focus on low-carb, high-fat diets and also ancestral Paleolithic diets, and perhaps we can talk a little bit more about that later.
Well, since you've mentioned that, Jamie Doucette, what do you think about high-fat, low-carb diets and ancestral diets?
Well, I think that many patients, I think early in the early 90s, it was very popular to go extremely low-fat to try to prevent or reduce the risk of heart disease. And actually, those studies, if you look at them, they were very specific. They were high in fiber. They were low in calorie compared to expenditure, so it truly was a weight loss type diet. And then extremely low fat, less than 10 grams a day, was what Dean Ornish recommended. And actually, if you did follow that high fiber, reduced calorie diet, you could see reductions in coronary disease by following a diet such as that. But I believe the food industry took that to mean that it didn't matter if you ate carbs or sugar. And they said, we can make everything low fat. We'll put sugar in the diet. And I think that whole mantra is what's responsible in large part for the obesity epidemic in our country, along with inactivity, of course.
How is heart disease doing in the United States? Are we doing a better job at avoiding heart attacks?
Yes, cardiovascular mortality is down by 50% over the last 10 years. So there have been great strides, in large part because of family docs like Jeff who have put patients on medications and also focused on diet and exercise as a way to reduce disease.
Yes, Jamie. I agree that I think modern medicine has really helped to reduce the events of cardiac disease, heart attack, death from heart attack. But unfortunately, I think we might even blame nutritional guidelines for not helping the situation. And we like to look at some common grounds in terms of nutrition. What does everybody agree is common and good? And we all agree that eating real food, clean foods, unprocessed foods. I think mainstream medicine today are talking about moderate diets. And there's some very good things about moderate diets where we're reducing carbohydrates in the diet, perhaps eating healthier carbohydrates. And also they talk about eating healthier fats in the diet. But truly, when we look at some of the data over the last 10 years, all diets probably work, including the low-fat, low-calorie diets, because you're reducing calories in total and definitely reducing carbohydrate load in the diet. And we believe that carbohydrate, especially refined and processed carbohydrates, are responsible for inflammation and oxidative stress. And those are some of the factors that we want to look at in diet in the 21st century, eating clean foods and unprocessed foods.
Jamie Doucette, is there some common ground here between you and Dr. Jeff Gerber, or do you have some contrast that you see?
No, absolutely. I always tell my patients that if it comes in a bag or a box, it can put you in one. So I think it's not good to eat processed foods that has extremely long shelf lives. It's not good for your body.
And you're not a fan of sugar in the diet, too, and there's a lot of sugar in the American diet.
For sure.
well, you know, this is a call-in show. And to our listeners who are listening in, this is your opportunity to speak to two experts on heart health and health in general. Call us here at 303-442-4242 if you have some questions for Jamie Doucette or Jeff Gerber. Jamie Doucette, cardiologist, Jeff Gerber, family doctor, give us a call with your comments or your questions, and we'll have you on air as soon as we can. Now, Jamie Doucette, is diet the only thing that you look at to help people prevent heart disease?
Well, I think that obesity is a huge problem in our country, especially when it's associated with other factors that go along with it, such as hypertension, diabetes being the big one, and then also...
Now, hypertension, what is that? High blood pressure?
Elevated blood pressure. Yeah, sorry for the jargon there. We, doctors speak in our own language, which is sometimes difficult for patients. I should be better about that.
Well, you're explaining just fine. So, but that's something. If somebody has high blood pressure, and do most people know whether they have high blood pressure or not?
I think it's still called the silent killer because there's very limited symptoms until it causes a stroke or a heart attack. And the way to measure the blood pressure is to see your physician, or even many of the drug companies have, or drug stores have, great little automatic machines that do quite well in measuring pressure, actually.
And so that's another measure that somebody can do. What do you think of cholesterol and checking the blood cholesterol of somebody? How important is that today? Because that's what most people think about when they think about checking for heart attack risk.
Yeah, we were talking about this before we came on air, and I'd like to hear Jeff's comments. But I think that the disease that is blockage or atherosclerosis that forms in arteries and causes them to harden and become dysfunctional is related to an initial injury of the lining or skin that lines the inner lining of the blood vessel. And then at any level, be that injury caused by elevated pressure in the blood vessel, smoking, elevated sugar and diabetes, or elevated cholesterol, all of those would help to lead to further plaque formation.
And so it's a scratch inside of the arteries, or it's a pimple, if you will, that the body's trying to repair, and that causes it to put things on it that don't always help the artery in the long run.
That's my view of it, and I think that that's consistent with what the biology would show. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, I agree with you 100%, Jamie. And specifically about cholesterol, I really enjoy talking about this because there's some new views about cholesterol and its role in atherosclerotic plaque. And so traditionally, based on some principles that we refer to as the diet heart hypothesis and the lipid hypothesis, says that it perhaps is the lipoprotein or the cholesterol molecule itself that is directly causing endothelial dysfunction. But of late, for myself in the last 10 years, there's this new concept that it is actually forces of inflammation and oxidative stress acting on the lipoprotein molecule itself that's responsible for inflammation. And we think of cholesterol and lipoprotein molecules perhaps as innocent bystanders that are victims to inflammation and oxidative stress.
Well, let me see if I'm understanding this right. A lipoprotein is the bag that carries the fat, the cholesterol, through the bloodstream. The endothelial cells are the linings of the arteries. And so you're mentioning that it may not be the fat that's being carried in the bag. It may be something wrong with the bag carrying the fat, the protein bag, that causes more of the inflammation that irritates the arteries.
Yes, that's correct, Shelley. And we have, fortunately or not, referred to this as the general issue of cholesterol, but it's really this complex molecule known as lipoprotein that interacts with this endothelium.
We're going to be taking our first caller in just a moment, but first, Jamie Doucette, what do you think of this lipid, this fat hypothesis?
Well, we know that LDL cholesterol is an oxidated LDL cholesterol is in the plaques in the bases of the craters that become heart attacks. So we know that cholesterol is involved. I agree with Jeff that cholesterol is not, we shouldn't just think of LDL cholesterol as cholesterol. It is actually a low-density lipoprotein carrier of cholesterol. because your blood is a saline type solution, and if you put fat in that, it would precipitate out. That is, it would coalesce and not allow for blood to flow.
Oh, so since it's a salty water, the blood is basically salty water, and if you put a drop of fat into that salty water, it would just float on the surface. It wouldn't go where it needs to.
That's correct. If you don't believe me, just take a glass of warm water, dissolve some salt in it, and then pour some olive oil on top of it and see what happens. If you put a protein thread throughout that cholesterol, then it has positive and minus charges on its ends, and that allows for it to remain in solution without precipitating out or dividing like that.
And the quality of that protein affects the quality of your health.
Correct.
Well, that is quite, there's a lot to know about hearts and health and how our bodies work. Let's bring onto the line a caller. Kate, welcome to KGNU.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. What comment or question do you have for our two doctors?
I do have a comment and a question, but I'm wondering if you can fix the connection. I'm hearing a beeping sound.
You know, I'm afraid that we can't. We have a bit of a problem with our phones, so if you can live with that, we would love to live with your call.
I will try to.
Okay.
I was diagnosed with chronic migraine, and I've been working with a myriad of doctors and nutritionists who have helped me heal. And the nutritionist has talked to me extensively about maintaining the paleo diet, which I have been for about a year now. And I found it to be incredibly helpful in working with the anti-inflammatory part of it, which is anti-gluten, dairy, and sugar. The part that I find really difficult and what I'd like to hear the doctors comment on is navigating that in our society where we are constantly inundated with information that goes against this way of eating, against the fats that are good in the paleo diet and so much red meat or protein. I'd love to hear your comments, and I'll take them on the air.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Kate. I'll go ahead and pot you down for a bit so that the sound is
great.
Simpler. That's an interesting question. First of all, what do you both think of the paleo diet, and can one of you describe the paleo diet?
Yeah, well, Kate, first of all, I hope you're having some success with the paleo diet. And as we said initially, the paleo diet is one of the diets that we focus on specifically for its anti-inflammatory properties. And so within the last 10 years or so, there has been popularity in these particular diets, we focus, again, because of their anti-inflammatory properties, and some people refer to them as caveman diets, and I think there's a bit of hokiness associated with it, but when we approach it, we think of it as eating clean foods, real foods, unprocessed foods, cutting out foods that are typically inflammatory in the diet, particularly wheat products, legumes. Dairy may be an issue for other people. And what we see in those diets is tending to eat less refined and processed foods as carbohydrates and more natural fats. And yes, that includes animal fats and saturated fats. And it turns out coconut oil and saturated fats may be very good for the brain, very good for all kinds of issues such as migraine and the such.
Jamie Doucette, the American Heart Association is not a fan yet of saturated fat. What do you think?
Well, I think that hard for me to say this out loud and on air, but I'm not sure that the American Heart Association has always had a great feel for what dietary things we could do to improve health, especially in regards to heart disease. And if you look at diet as a predictor of survival, actually, the people that live the longest live in fertile river valleys near where there are floods and river deltas, and therefore it goes without saying that those people eat more organic produce and their produce is actually higher in quality. So I think that what Jeff is espousing or talking about is exactly correct, and that is that we eat way too many carbohydrates, we eat way too many foods that are inflammatory and overly processed for purposes of storage as opposed to and we don't really have those needs any longer that we have modern refrigeration, et cetera.
You mean the shelf life is better, but unfortunately, these kinds of foods cause more storage on our bodies of fat.
I think that's true.
What would the American Heart Association say with you, a cardiologist, saying things like this?
I'm not sure. I think that a lot of them, that if they really studied the science behind diet, they would understand that if you feed someone an increased calorie diet compared to expenditure that is low in fiber, they do that north of here in Greeley to a sedentary population, and they do that in the feedlots with cattle. So that's a good way to fatten someone up. And that's exactly the way the diets that were espoused by the American Heart Association in the late 80s and early 90s, if people didn't follow the high fiber part and the reduced calorie compared to expenditure until they got to ideal body weight, then it's a way to create an obesity epidemic and an epidemic of diabetes.
Now, Jamie, we only have you here for a little bit longer, Dr. Jamie Doucette, because you need to go see clients. And so I've got a couple more questions for you. One is about medications, and the other is about stress. How important are each of these to preventing heart disease or contributing to it?
Well, I think medications have made huge strides in spite of diabetes and obesity. I think that the medications, along with patients and their physicians working together to try to alter some of these things that we know cause heart attack, have significantly reduced cardiovascular mortality in spite of kind of a more ill population.
So people are getting sicker because of their lifestyle, but we have some medications that are running hard to try to keep up with that.
And actually beating the pace. So we talked about cholesterol before. There are some people that believe that it's really not about cholesterol necessarily, or LDL, which is supposedly the bad cholesterol versus the good, the HDL. But it actually has a lot to do with particle size and number. That is, if you take the amount of cholesterol that's the bad stuff in your bloodstream and actually look at what it's made of, it turns out if you have a lot of little bags, to use your verbiage that you used before, that are carrying around the LDL cholesterol, and you have thousands of those particles that make up your amount of LDL, that is, your number is 100 milligrams per deciliter at the health fair, right? If one person has thousands of very tiny particles and another person has hundreds of very large ones, the one with thousands of particles is much more likely to have a heart attack and atherosclerosis.
And so you want big, fluffy LDL particles and not small, dense BB gun-sized particles.
And you don't want a lot of it either, so that's true. I mean, I think most, ways to identify disease are often found in the most extreme examples. And in patients that don't have an LDL cholesterol receptor in their liver to remove the LDL, then those patients have heart attacks and strokes in their 20s. And the Nobel Prize was won for realizing that there were patients that didn't have an LDL receptor, that is, in their liver. Once the LDL was in their bloodstream, it was there pretty much to stay.
Are you talking about familial hypercholesterolemia?
Yes, and those patients have LDL total cholesterols in the 500 range and LDL cholesterols in the 300 range. So extremes of things can sometimes point out that can guide us to where. So I think cholesterol does play a role, and I think it's erroneous to believe that it doesn't.
Well, you mentioned also that people at a health fair where they get their cholesterol checked, that may not be the best kind.
Well, some people, especially in diabetes research, are beginning to look at saying that we shouldn't use screening LDL cholesterol and total cholesterol as a way to look for disease, but rather look at particle size and number. What do you think about that, Jeff?
Well, first of all, Jamie, it's a pleasure talking to you. You're saying a lot of things that I like to hear from a cardiologist. And so I think cholesterol is important, and it does play a role. Some people even argue that the particle size may not actually matter. that in terms of looking at oxidative stress, sometimes just looking at the total cholesterol to HDL ratio, looking at triglyceride to HDL ratio may give us some great information about oxidative stress. But let's talk about LDL particles. And even on some of these paleo or low-carb diets, in the majority of patients, we see cholesterol profile improve in every single way. But there's an exception where some people, the LDL cholesterol or the LDL particle count or the ApoB count will rise. And the question is, what's the significance? So in a traditional sense, we don't want LDL particles to rise. And I actually agree that's potentially concerning. But we have to take in and consider oxidative stress. So in patients that are doing everything in their life to reduce oxidative stress, such as a low-carb diet or a paleo diet, when we see LDL particle rise in a state of low oxidation, maybe that's not a bad thing. But when we looked at patients that are on standard American diets and they have a very high LDL particle count vis-a-vis a high oxidative state, then perhaps that high LDL particle count is much more concerning. And there may indeed be a role for medications such as statins in those patients that can't make positive lifestyle modifications.
Jamie, I see you nodding.
Well, I totally agree with you. I've seen patients. I practice here in Boulder, so there are a lot of patients here that are very interested in treating their problem with diet and exercise, et cetera, and they're very conscious of health. And we have excellent stores here that provide us with great produce, even though we're kind of in the center of an arid, you know, environment. My impression of patients that go on a paleo diet and then I track their cholesterol is that their cholesterol profiles generally do improve compared to their standard diet. And also, interestingly, it seems that most of the patients that have a low HDL, and we haven't talked about that yet, but HDL is considered the good cholesterol, and there are HDL-2B, which is a subtype of HDL, is actually involved in reverse cholesterol transport. It can go to the vessel wall, pick up a piece of cholesterol debris, and then bring it back to the liver for processing or elimination. So in my experience, when patients have gone on the paleo diet and have a low HDL and a family history to boot, generally their HDL goes up. So I think that probably does, in fact, overwhelm any increases in oxidative LDL. What's your thought about that, Jeff?
Yeah, so I think HDL plays into it. In fact, it brings up for me the issue of lifestyle versus medication. And there were some trials in HDL medications in the last year, and they were a great failure. And their conclusion was that HDL therapy doesn't do anything. Well, I so disagree with the conclusion. An artificial therapy such as a medication to raise HDL may have no effect, but that says nothing about a lifestyle modification that raises HDL in a healthy way.
The study that Jeff is referencing is very interesting, and I think anyone that looks at the biochemistry of how that drug affected an increase in HDL in the bloodstream was that it actually blocked the ability of the liver to take HDL out of the bloodstream, thereby increasing HDL levels in the blood. In my view, that's kind of like blocking the entrance to the dump where the HDL is trying to get back and get rid of these particles that shouldn't be there. And actually, the very large pharmaceutical company bet basically $1 billion. They spent $1 billion that this drug would reverse coronary disease. And in fact, the patients were more likely to die, have a stroke or heart attack if they were on that medication. And I think for the very reason that I just mentioned, they took away those patients' ability to get rid of bad cholesterol.
Well, Dr. Jamie Doucette, you make it sound like this medication, this billion-dollar medication, just put a whole bunch of stale, old, worn-out HDL in the bloodstream and made it stay there.
I think that's really it's probably an extreme oversimplification, but because the biology of these particles is extremely complex, but I think that and they've been studied extensively. But I do agree with Jeff about that, and you know, niacin in its pharmaceutical form, which is vitamin B3, is the only drug in quote that is approved by the FDA for plaque reversal. All the rest are considered plaque stabilizing drugs, and it's actually a vitamin.
Speaking of plaque, what do you think of calcium heart scans?
They're fantastic studies. I think that especially if the information is used in a judicious way, most importantly by cardiologists, if the high score or a calcium score, first of all, I guess I should just describe what that is. Basically, a calcium scan is actually a CT scan, which is a computerized X-ray-based technology that we've all heard of CT scans. Basically, it identifies calcium in bone very, very easily. Recently, in the last 10, 15 years, the resolution of those machines has gotten to a level that they can actually, and the speed has increased to a level that it actually can render the moving heart immobile. And then the sensitivity of the machine is to detect actual calcium volume in your vessel wall. And then a very brilliant guy by the name of Agatston, who's actually a very good cardiologist in Florida, more famous for inventing the South Beach diet, which is a low carbohydrate diet, and I think this guy is really smart, invented the Agatston score, where you can actually tell how much calcified plaque you have in your vessel wall compared to other age and sex match controls. If the test is used to identify someone that is asymptomatic but then has plaque and needs to adopt lifestyle and dietary changes along possibly with medication to stabilize or even, in my view, reverse the amount of plaque in their vessel wall, then it's ideal. If the test is then used to go do an angiogram in an asymptomatic patient, which is an invasive test, without further testing that suggests that's necessary, then it becomes less valuable. So patients, actually, this is one of two tests that you can order on yourself. And those two are mammograms, of course, and also checking for plaque in your heart circulation.
Well, right now, this test is not paid for by insurance. The American Heart Association has not endorsed it as something that would be a useful test enough to pay for by an insurance. Would you like to see that changed?
Absolutely. The problem with using a stress test,
meaning on a treadmill and running
yes,
very hard,
in someone that's asymptomatic, is it only detects patients that have an obstructive plaque. That is a greater than 70% obstruction in the blood vessel. So if you looked, considered the coronary artery like a hose that brings blood, life-giving blood to your heart muscle, if it is 70% obstructed or greater, then the stress test would be abnormal in the way that the EKG looks when you do an exercise load on the heart. But if you have a 50% plaque or a 40% plaque or a 30% plaque, your stress test is going to be normal.
Well, which kind of thing causes more heart attacks, a plugged up artery or just a piece of plaque that breaks off and ends up causing a clot?
Well, everyone talks about plaque breaking off, but really what happens is you have oxidative stress or some kind of injury to the lining of the inner lining of the blood vessel. Your body, as part of this is how I view it at least, your body, as part of that healing process, sends cholesterol particles to regrow the cellular membranes that are there. If you have too great of a deposit, then your body wants to remove that LDL cholesterol with something called macrophages. They actually eat those plaques like a Pac-Man would, if you will, and then they commit suicide. And when they do that, it leads to inflammation. So it's the process of plaque endothelial injury, which is skin lining injury, then plaque formation, and then inflammation that subsequently leads to heart attack. And when that happens, what really happens is the skin that covers that cholesterol debris or inflammatory pimple, if you will, inside the blood vessel, the endothelium tends to rupture, and when it does that, your body recognizes that like a cut in your skin anywhere, even on the outside, and it sends clotting factors to repair the hole, including very angry platelets. And when that happens, if that occludes the whole blood vessel, then all the heart muscle downstream from that generally begins to die. So if it's in a tiny little branch of your heart circulation, you may just have a bad day at the gym. But if it happens in the very first part of your heart circulation, like the left anterior descending artery that everyone calls the widowmaker, it kills 50% of people within 2 hours. And that's where I become very valuable.
Is to save someone's life in that terrible time.
That's where you really need an interventional cardiologist like myself with the modern stuff. But Jeff and I were talking about air, and I want Jeff to comment on this. His whole goal and my whole goal has become to try to prevent people from having those heart attacks in the first place. And in this disease, certainly a pound of prevention is worth – an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Now,
what do you think, Jeff?
Well, before we go to that, we do have a caller on the line. Should we get the caller on? Jeff is giving you a thumbs up. And Dr. Jamie Doucette, the question I have for you also is, can you stay? It's 9:06.
Sure, I can stay.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad that your schedule lets you stay. I'm glad. So let's go ahead and get, if it's all right with you all, let's go ahead and get the next caller on the line. Jay from Evergreen, welcome to KGNU.
Hello.
Hi there. Yes, can you hear us?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I'm not sure where to start. I don't want to give you too much information. I've been on like a roller coaster ride for the last few months. I was in the emergency room with chest pains back in September, which has happened a few times before. And every time this happens, they find nothing wrong with my heart. But my doctor decided to schedule a stress test, treadmill test anyway. The treadmill was abnormal, which shocked the heck out of me, because I consider myself really healthy. You know, I went on the South Beach diet 10 years ago and dropped 50 pounds, and I've been very careful about my diet. I get a lot of exercise. And then they scheduled an angiogram, which showed 3 blocked arteries, and they said they scheduled me for triple bypass. And I was supposed to have that in January, but in the meantime, I went back in the hospital with more of these chest pains, and I was hospitalized for several days. They test, you know, they did all the tests. They did nuclear imaging and ultrasound, and ultimately decided not to do the surgery, but to, you know, to control the disease with medications, which I thought was great news. Ultimately, they decided that the pains were most likely due to acid reflux.
Well, but, and so that is quite a fascinating history. And let's go ahead and have the doctors talk. Here's one thing to know. Also, they are not going to be diagnosing over the air, because we can't really do that.
No, I don't want to diagnose.
But if you can wrap it up in about a minute, that would be good.
Well, the thing is, I'm on medication, and in the meantime, I got hold of every heart book I could find. I got Agustin's book, I got Dean Ornish's book, and Mark Houston. And I don't want to just what the cardiologists tell me is just keep taking your meds, and maybe you'll never have to have surgery, or maybe you will. But I don't want to do that. I want to do what I can to reverse this if I can.
Sure, that's understandable.
But I get all this conflicting information, you know, high fat, low fat, and all this stuff. I just don't know where to go from here. If your guests could make some kind of suggestion as to what, you know, what I can do for myself.
Good, good question. Let's have them answer the call now.
Right.
Who wants to take this?
Okay, I'll go first. So once you have plaque, I think that medication, there may be a role for it until we can make a lifestyle modification. And it brings us back to factors in your lifestyle that you can change. So if you smoke, not to smoke. alcohol, exercise, you know, cutting back on alcohol, exercise, I think, is important. And then it brings us back to the issue of what is it in the diet that is going to reduce oxidative stress and inflammation? And in terms of diets across the board, eliminating refined and processed foods, especially sugars, vegetable oils also play a role in inflammation. In fact, there was a recent study from the NIH from an old study back in Australia.
And that's the National Institutes of Health.
The National Institutes of Health, and they resurrected some information from it was the Sydney Diet Heart Study back in the 1960s, and they discovered that patients that were consuming in this randomized controlled trial, they replaced saturated fat with vegetable oil, in particular linoleic acid, which is omega-6, which we knew has been inflammatory.
And that's safflower oil, that's soy oil, that's corn oil. That's the kind of oil that your French fries will be fried in most cases.
Right. So the original guidelines from the 1960s was that we should indeed replace saturated fat with vegetable oils. And at Discovery, this study showed that, unfortunately, the incidence of all-cause mortality, heart attack and death from heart attack actually increased on the group that consumed vegetable oils.
Vegetable oil instead of but you see,
saturated fat.
The American Heart Association, the USDA food policy for schools is to use vegetable oils instead of using saturated fat.
Well, I think we're on a steep learning curve. And so the point here, getting back to the caller's question, is what is it that we can do in our diet to reduce oxidative stress and inflammation? And from my perspective, this is why we focus on low-carb, high-fat diets for patients that are particularly insulin-resistant and have a lot of weight to lose. And patients that don't necessarily have a lot of weight to lose are not as much insulin resistant, which is a precursor to diabetes, do well on ancestral and Paleolithic diets, which we consider to be anti-inflammatory.
Jamie Doucette, do you want to add to these comments?
Well, the first thing would be about the patient that's called in here, and I don't want to diagnose you over the phone, but or over the air. But when you have obstructive coronary disease that is limiting blood flow to the heart muscle on the basis of an angiogram, and there's more than one artery that's involved in that obstruction, a triple bypass would mean that they would effectively put another conduit downstream from the area that is blocked so that the heart is receiving adequate blood flow. I think it's somewhat cavalier of physicians to say that your chest discomfort that's recurrent and bad enough to get you to an emergency department is related to some problem with your stomach. What you're describing is pre-infarction angina, which means that if you're having recurrent chest discomfort and, in fact, the pain that you're experiencing is related to your heart circulation, then, in fact, bypass surgery has been proven in those patients to improve mortality if you take all comers. So that's the reason that at that point in time, sometimes it's best to start over, become revascularized. That way your heart's receiving adequate blood flow, get an appropriate surgery, and then continue on with the diet and exercise to try to salvage that situation.
Thank you for those comments, Dr. Jamie Doucette, cardiologist. Jay, we're going to add one more opinion into this or suggestions coming from Steve Parcell, naturopathic physician Steve Parcell, who has just joined us. Welcome, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, I like what Dr. Doucette said, because I was going to ask the caller again what his actual question was, because I thought I heard that he had three-vessel disease. And so is the question, can he reverse this with diet? Or, I mean,
yeah,
I'm confused.
Yes, I mean, for instance, Dean Ornish claims that his program
okay.
will reverse it.
Yeah, there's only a couple studies on the dietary reversal of extensive atherosclerosis like that. So, and I really don't understand why they they didn't think your chest pain was due to that when it's already been documented on an angiogram, I would say that your chest pain is due to a perfusion problem. And, you know,
that means the heart is not getting enough blood.
Yeah, I would consider you a high risk patient, and you need to have optimal lipids, and, you need to do everything you can to optimize your inflammatory profile as well as lipids. I would not, if you were my patient, I would not be sending you off to do various diets and hoping for the best. The chance of you reversing plaque that's that extensive with a special diet is limited, and I would be very concerned about a cardiovascular event.
Now, one question I have for all of you is stress. There is a lot of documentation that says that simply being overly stressed can make a huge difference on whether somebody is doing well with their heart or not. And this is over and above diet and exercise, that if you're just stressed in your life, that's going to cause some problems. Steve Parcell, would you like to comment on that?
Well, stress isn't going to help. It's sympathetic overload, which constricts the arteries and can induce chest pain, raises blood pressure. I mean, this is a patient who needs everything optimized. Stress needs to be optimal. Blood pressure needs to be optimal. Lipids need to be optimal. Diet needs to be optimal. And then I guess you could cross your fingers and you could get a heart scan. You could do another one in a year and you could look at your progression. I mean, to some patients, they refuse surgery. I would say, get a heart scan. Let's do everything we can for a year. And if your progression is reasonable, okay, that's one thing. If your progression is, 25% or more, that's very bad news. And the risk is even worse.
Jay, thank you for your question. We're going to go to the next caller, who is Roger. Hold on just a second, Roger, and we'll get you on the phone. Roger, welcome to KGNU.
Good morning, Shelley. What a great program. I'll be brief. I'm wondering if your guests are familiar with John A. McDougall, MD, and his various programs, especially his latest book, The Starch Solution, where he advocates a lot of rice and beans and potatoes and those kinds of things, little or no meat and no processed foods, combined with exercise and other healthy initiatives. Are your guests familiar with John McDougall, and would they support something like the starch solution?
Steve Parcell, let's let you talk about this first.
I can't stand protocols named after doctors or solutions or anything like that. Diet is not one size fits all. And just as our previous guest said, you have to match the diet to the patient. If this is an insulin resistant patient or a diabetic patient, that would be a disaster. So these one size fits all diets are terrible. There's basically good carbs, good proteins, and good fats. And the reverse is also true. There's bad fats, bad proteins, and bad starches and bad carbs. And, of course you could do a low fat, high carb, high fiber, good, healthy carb diet, but you got to match it to the patient. In some patients, their lipids are going to get worse. Their small LDL will increase on a diet like that. So I don't like that. There is no magic bullet dietary solution for reversing plaque, unless you're going to go super low fat and do the Ornish deal, because that's been clinically proven to work. But most people can't sustain it.
Steve Parcell, does that Dean Ornish style, very low fat, very high carb diet, work for everyone? Or are there also people where, say, they're diabetic, does
no
it
way.
Work for them?
No, it doesn't work. In fact, depending on your apolipoprotein E genotype, a high carb, low fat diet might actually make your small LDL increase and make your HDL go down.
How could somebody figure out if they're a good candidate for the McDougall diet or the Ornish diet?
Well, I like to do the ApoE test as some kind of guidepost.
So that's apolipoprotein E, which is a certain kind of basically bag of cholesterol that's going through the bloodstream, or bag of fat.
Well, it's really it's genetic polymorphisms in the metabolism of cholesterol, and there is some data to suggest that moderate fat Mediterranean diet is better for one, and low fat's better for a certain other type, and then it tends to work when you do follow up lipid profiles.
Would one of you other doctors like to comment on this as well, this idea of going on a low-fat, high-carb diet, the kind that Roger has suggested?
So, yes.
So, Jeff Gerber.
Sure. Yes, Steve. So, the ApoE genetic testing, I think what it demonstrates is that people are different genetically and they have a different response to dietary modification and how that affects LDL particles. And as you probably are aware by now, I'm not very fond of these very low-fat, high-carb diets. And I agree with Steve that some people can have the reverse effect. Some have even challenged the data of Dean Ornish. And so perhaps, I mean, I just can't find a role for an extreme low-fat, high-carb diet in 2013.
Dr. Jamie Doucette, cardiologist, what's your comment?
I think that what Steve and Jeff have already said is quite correct. The data on high carbohydrate and extremely low-fat diets was, again, from Ornish and a guy named Lance Gould, G-O-U-L-D, who's at the University of Texas and in Health Sciences Center in Houston, and I actually trained under him directly, so I actually know him personally. And Lance, or Dr. Gould, please forgive me if you ever hear this, but he's quite, he's 6 feet six tall and weighs about 180 pounds. He's extremely thin, and he does follow a extremely reduced calorie diet compared to expenditure, and is quite lean. It's hard for people to stay on that diet, like Steve mentioned, where it truly is reduced calorie compared to expenditure. One of the main things that tells you to stop eating is fat intake. And when you don't have that, or you don't have the will to have that assistance, then people tend to then cheat on these types of diets, and then that becomes the worst kind of diet you could possibly be on.
Well, people can cheat on a high-fat, low-carb diet also.
And that's bad for them as well, and it doesn't result in as good of lipid profiles. I totally agree with both these physicians that really there's not a single diet that works for everyone. If you have prediabetes and you go on a high-carbohydrate, extremely low-fat diet, your triglycerides will go up, your HDL will go down, and your LDL will be unchanged or slightly reduced. And that combination would be bad for your heart and your vascular system, in my view.
If you would like to call and share your comment or question with our panel of experts, the number is 303-442-4242. This is a show on heart health. We have just a few minutes left. Roger, since you're still on the line, what do you think of these comments from these doctors about the McDougal diet?
Well, I don't know that much about it, but they sound very insightful, and it gives me a lot to think about because, as one of the doctors suggested, he wasn't comfortable with an author suggesting a one-size-fits-all diet. And that seems to be the case with John McDougall and the starch solution, although McDougall bases this on human history and what our ancestors ate and all those kinds of things. So it gives me a lot to think about, and I really appreciate their comments. Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you, Roger. And just so you know, our panel of experts, something about these conversations right now made the lines light up. We're going to get a call soon about a comment about this. But first, it's Dr. Boring. Jamie Doucette, cardiologist, what's your comment?
Well, I think what McDougall bases his on is basically Asia. And you have to remember that Asian people are genetically different than a lot of the patients that we have in America. So what may work very well and prevent heart disease in Asia may not actually prevent heart disease in someone of European or African descent as an example. Do you agree with that, Jeff?
To comment more on that, I agree, Jamie. In fact, what our finding is that when we look at Eastern Asians, they tend to be insulin sensitive and carbohydrate tolerant, and they tend to not gain a lot of weight. But then later in life, say over age 65, we see these patients, and guess what? Their pancreas is burnt out, and they're type 2 diabetic.
And in fact, I believe that when Asians move to the United States and start eating the American diet, they start to get the same health problems as anyone else in the United States is prone to. And additionally, China has one of the highest rates right now of diabetes and obesity in the world because it's becoming more prosperous and more Western in how that country eats. We do have a caller on the hold on a second. I'll see if I can get another caller on the line. What do you do when somebody comes to you and says, I want to find some way to eat? How do you tell that they're doing what they think they're doing? There's a lot of Worried looks here that that's a hard thing. Go ahead, Jeff Gerber.
I guess that's what we really enjoy doing in our office is do a metabolic workup of patients that come in. And it's very simple. Of course, history, you look at the family history. But we like to do a two-hour glucose tolerance test, which helps us to measure the degree of insulin resistance. Some basic things, lipid profiles, C-peptide, insulin, cardiac CRP. Homocysteine. The list goes on, but we always like to think of getting the biggest bang for your buck and just doing some simple tests to get a feel for the metabolic profile of the individual.
And how about you, Dr. Steve Purcell?
I agree. Same thing. Individualized care, workup, blood work, metabolic profile, lipids, and follow-up.
Dr. Jamie Doucette, as a cardiologist, you see people when they have been at death's door quite often.
Well, I try to reduce that in my own patients by being very careful about their follow-up and that kind of thing. The majority of patients that I see that have heart attacks now are patients that I don't have a relationship with, and they're coming into the emergency department because of some kind of acute coronary syndrome.
An acute coronary syndrome means something has just happened that's really bad.
A spectrum of it means that plaque has formed, it's been inflamed, and it's ruptured, and there's clot usually involved in that, and inside the heart circulation itself. And, of course, that is a very dangerous situation, and it runs the whole spectrum from a threatened heart attack to a real heart attack and sudden death.
We're going to try to see if there's another caller on the line. We've had a bit of problems with the phones this morning, but let's just see. Hello, is there a caller on the line? I'm afraid we're having some problems with our phones, so let's just assume that we're needing to wrap up because it's 9:27 and we should be done at 9:30. So what is a quick comment from each of you on what you think the best thing is someone can do to take care of their heart? Let's start with you, Dr. Steve Purcell.
Well, number one is, in your 30s, you really should be getting an annual physical, and you need to be addressing lipids and other traditional risk factors early on and looking at family history. And then as time goes on, I'm a believer in the carotid intima media thickness test as well as the coronary calcium scoring. As asymptomatic atherosclerosis screening tests, and it helps determine risk. And that way you can catch it early. You'll never end up under the knife or, in the cath lab.
You don't want to be in the cath lab. How about you, Dr. Jamie Doucette?
Well, I get paid to do procedures in cath labs, but it'd be my preference to be put out of business in that regard. And I totally agree with Steve that looking for plaque before it's had a chance to build up to a level that it limits blood flow to the brain, heart, or the rest of the body, finding asymptomatic plaque gets buy-in from patients that I do have this disease, I need to, and they get better about their diet and they get better about their exercise. And they also follow recommendations where medications may be necessary or beneficial.
And Dr. Jeff Gerber, 30, 45 seconds, what would you say?
Sure. Steve had mentioned carotid IMT, which is a competing technology to heart scans, calcium scores. I think they're all wonderful technologies. We do CIMTs in our office as well. We view atherosclerotic plaque and heart attack and heart disease as a chronic metabolic disease, and we really want to address it with lifestyle issues. Plaque takes 30 to 40 years to develop, and so it starts as it's a lifelong goal to make change.
Thank you all for joining us, Drs. Steve Purcell, naturopathic physician, Dr. Jamie Doucette, cardiologist with, what is your center again?
Boulder Heart is the name of our organization at Boulder Community Hospital.
And Dr. Jeff Gerber with?
Denver's Diet Doctor.
Denver's Diet Doctor. So NatureMed Clinic, Steve Purcell, Jamie Doucette, say it one more time.
Boulder Heart is our new organization.
And Jeff Gerber?
Denver's Diet Doctor.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Shelley Schlender. This concludes our discussion about heart health. You can hear more about all of this that we've had in this series by going to eatyourradio.org and putting in the search term heart attack, and we'll have all of this posted there. Thank you again.